I do try to do that. It's having grown up at that time with that set of rather inspirational figures as models and mentors. I certainly also believe that one should write history for a broad public audience and that it's a public cultural enterprise as well as a university and academic one. Insofar as I think about the audience when I write, I tend to think that it's my undergraduate classes who've just grown a bit older. It seems to me that that's why undergraduate teaching is important, because actually, although it's in a university, an undergraduate audience is a public audience. And in a sense, as I grow older and as they grow older, I want to stay in touch with them. And the way to do that is to write books that I hope they read.
When you begin the subject, when you begin the work to tell the story of someone like Andrew Mellon, you roll up the sleeves, you begin research. I mean, does it start at 8 a.m. one day and then?
Well, the Mellon Project was wholly unlike any other book I've written, in that it was undertaken at the request of the Andrew Mellon Foundation, and they generously supplied research assistance. So what I was doing with that book, and it's the only book I've written that way, was presiding over a large research project. I had three or four research assistants over a period of about 10 years. Because one of the difficulties with those guys, that generation, is that the archival material is huge. I think we consulted about 65 archival collections in the course of generating the research material. And I ended up, thanks to the labours of the research assistants, over which I kept a very sharp eye, I should say, with about 24 boxes of, that was the distilled material of Andrew Mellon's life. And these 24 boxes followed me around the world, here in North America, in Britain and in Australia, where I wrote quite a large part of the book, as I actually wrote the book. So that was quite a complicated project, because the research was done first. And once that was done, I then started to write. Normally, when it's a book that, as it were, I'm doing all the work for myself, I tend to start writing much earlier, and often have to scrap all that. But the only way to work out what you think is to start writing. And so often the research and the writing go on simultaneously, whereas in the Mellon case, they were two very distinct and sequential enterprises.
I would imagine being a historian, though, can be frustrating when you're trying to find those links or those connections or a particle of the story that is hard to put your hand on?
Yes, it's a constant worry for all historians, I think, that there's an awful lot of what happened in the past that was very important and that we ought to know about, that we just can't know about because the archival material isn't there. Put the other way, if you want historians to take note of you, then you need to make sure that you leave behind an archive. Though, of course, in the current world we're in, where most material is now electronic, that of itself is a much more vexed issue than it used to be. But one can see why American presidents want presidential libraries. It's a way of ensuring that posterity will take notice of them.
Of course, if you're a figure, you try to control perhaps a little bit of what is archived and what is not.
I think that's right. I mean, I think having control of one's archive is quite important. And, of course, by definition, we rarely know what people who have important archives have actually chosen to allow us to see, and we don't know what's been destroyed. So the whole notion of the historical record in terms of archives is problematic for that reason, and also, as I mentioned, increasingly because all the business of the White House now is conducted electronically, and nobody is quite sure yet how that can be preserved across the next 100 years. And it may well be that historians of our time will actually have a much harder job of things than historians in our time of earlier times, because in fact there won't be, in the way that there is up until the 1980s, a substantial, literally documentary record to look at.
That you can hold and
yeah, see and touch and read on the page.
Are there figures that you are more interested in that you will perhaps never write about, but if given the right set of circumstances, the right beach, the right time away from work, you would want to know much more about?
Yes, I mean, I think there's no limit to the historical figures one would want to know more about. I suppose what also interests me as a historian is the difference between being, how can I put this, a professional biographer, which is what you do for a living, that's to say you write a sequence of lives, and being a historian whose take on individual figures, even such extraordinary larger-than-life figures as Winston Churchill, is in some ways different from that of a biographer. I mean, biographers want to create a life and they just go through from birth via what they do to death, and in a sense that's a kind of finished self-sufficient product. Any historian is always going to ask, how much difference did this life really make? What's the broader context that we need to sketch in, both to understand the life more fully, but also to get a sense of what the significance of the life really is? And I think in that sense, biographies written by historians are a different sort of animal, different sort of creature from biographies written by biographers. I'd want to say that they're better, but of course I would say that.
But understanding the ripples,
yeah,
and how they have affected.
Yes. I mean, for example, in The Mellon Life, I have a quotation from Frick, one of Mellon's great close business partners. And Frick says, you know, if you and I hadn't done it, somebody else would have come along and they'd have done it anyway. So that although, in fact, to understand the transformation of Western Pennsylvania, which is where Pittsburgh was, which is where they were based in the late 19th and early 20th century, one does have to take very substantial notice of Mellon and of Frick, who were two of the towering figures in that economic process of change. I think Frick was probably right that if Mellon and Frick hadn't showed up, somebody else would have done it. Well, that isn't to say that Mellon's life isn't important, but it is to put it in a slightly different perspective from saying, here is a big figure, I'm just going to tell you about him.
That must be at times, well, perhaps not intimidating, but I can imagine when you're trying to put that together and trying to rein in what's going to be included and what isn't going to be included between the front and the back cover.
Yes, I think getting the balance right is much harder for a historian. So that, back to Mellon again, for the late 19th and early 20th century period of his life, I was constantly worried that that part of their biography would become an economic history of Western Pennsylvania with occasional allusion to Andrew Mellon, which wouldn't have worked as a biography, though it's a serious historical subject. By the same token, when I got to the Republican administrations of Harding and Coolidge and Hoover, where Mellon was Secretary of the Treasury, I was worried that this would end up as a sort of economic and political history of the Republican administrations in which Andrew Mellon played a part, but only a part. And getting the balance right between the individual who you wish to foreground because it's a biography and the broader world without which they're not comprehensible, but which is constantly in danger of submerging them, getting that balance right is a constant challenge.
Finally, and no disrespect here, I want to ask about being knighted. And there's a sir in front of you. That is quite an honor. How does that happen? Those of us in this country have, I think, a fascination.
Well, first of all, I ought to say that when this happened, a friend of mine said to me, well, it's absolutely clear that the British aristocracy have declined and fallen if people like you are getting titles. So make of that what you will. Britain, in this sense, is part of what Donald Rumsfeld called old Europe. It's very important for Brits to remember that when America became independent, it abolished titles on the whole, unless you're honourable, which means you've been elected to some public position. Britain still has this elaborate hierarchy of honours and titles. It has an extraordinarily complicated honours system still. It's all secret and confidential, so you just get a letter in the mail saying, would you like to be knighted? And then you have to tear off a piece of paper at the bottom and tick the right box. It's like paying a gas bill, as it were, and you put it in an envelope and send it off and mail it in. So that's what happens. If you tick the box and say yes, it then appears there are two honours lists a year. One is a New Year's honours list, which comes out on December the 31st. One comes out in the summer on the Queen's official birthday. And if you've ticked the box and say yes, you hope all being well, your name will indeed appear in the newspaper, and so indeed mine did. And then you get lots of letters of congratulation, which is hugely pleasurable, to which it's customary and proper to handwrite replies. Nobody could read mine because my writing's illegible, but I wrote them off anyway. And then you show up at the palace and you kneel down, and the Prince of Wales, in my case, puts a sword on each side. They don't say arise, Sir David, but they do the thing with the sword. And then you get given a rather nice medal, which you can occasionally, but only rather rarely, wear.
So here is a historian, and now you are part of history.
Well, in a very, very, very minor way.
Yes.
But yes, I suppose my name will be on various lists, and if anybody in the future chooses to consult them, assuming that they're not just electronically available, they'll find my name and maybe wonder what I'm doing there.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.